Thank you for the invitation to speak here and for putting together such a great exhibition, which pulls together a lot of the individual history, the indigenous history, national history, which shouldn't be forgotten. And it also demonstrates, this exhibition, that Australia did not remain unaffected by the direct impact of the nuclear age, even though we never acquired reactors for power production or operated or hosted nuclear weapons for our defense. But that doesn't mean that Australia was remote from the nuclear age in its strategic impact, even if that impact was always a product of our strategic and geographic circumstances that changed over time and continue to do so. At the beginning of the atomic age, Australia very much saw nuclear weapons as the rightful preserve of the great powers. We were a bit late to realize their strategic importance in the 50s, but even before that, Menzies were very supportive of Britain's and the US nuclear programs as the foundations of the Western deterrence that might help prevent the next great conflict of the kind that just had devastated the Northern Hemisphere. And this exhibition here reminds us of the direct impacts that his support had on Australia and Australians. From the mid-1950s, Australian defense planners then were very much engaged in nuclear strike planning to defend Southeast Asia against a possible communist invasion in the now almost forgotten Southeast Asian Treaty Organization. By the 1960s, Australia's view on nuclear weapons changed again, as our views assumed a more nationalistic tone, like in Europe and amongst other allies, where Australia was looking somewhat askance at the new Kennedy administration's seeming reluctance to commit to the use of nuclear weapons to defend our allies. And China's nuclear weapon also seemed to bring the threat of nuclear weapons to Australia's shores, or closer to Australia's shores. But ultimately, the cause then for a sovereign nuclear capability never really pushed through, largely because, again, geostrategic circumstances changed. And it's important to remember that Australia, from probably the time that Nixon went to China to the Taiwan Straits crisis of the 1990s, was in a most unusual international situation in that we didn't have to worry about a great power conflict impacting on the country itself, other than in the context of global nuclear war. We could focus on regional conflict in which the use of nuclear weapons had almost no relevance to our own security. So Australia's policy on nuclear weapons in the 70s and 80s was very much ahead of its time for that reason. We could place ourselves at the forefront of a wider non-proliferation and disarmament movement and, if you like, foreshadow a lot of the agenda that then came to the international fore in the 90s and 2000s, whether that was the ultimate aim of nuclear disarmament, the reduction in the geographic deployment of nuclear weapons, the focus on environmental consequences of nuclear testing, the importance of preventing non-proliferation in the Third World, proliferation that was unrelated to the Cold War, or to give real teeth and build incentives into the non-proliferation regime. All of those were the focus on Australia because we didn't have to worry about the defense use of nuclear weapons in the 70s and 80s, and then also became the focus of the international community in the 1990s and 2000s. Because what was remarkable about those two decades is that the same situation that Australia was in the 70s and 80s seemed to like extend across the globe, that nuclear weapons seemed to have lost all their practical relevance with the end of the Cold War and largely just an inheritance that we had to manage and dispose of. So nuclear arsenals were radically cut. The attention of governments and militaries in almost all Western countries moved away from the operation of nuclear forces, and the U.S. almost completely lost its ability to produce nuclear weapons in quantities that are meaningful for great power confrontation. So during the 1990s and 2000s, in many ways, preventing accidents through complete elimination became a dominating narrative around nuclear weapons in Australia and also the large parts of the Northern Hemisphere, where even the problem of further proliferation to North Korea or Iran sometimes seemed to take second stage, because it posed somewhat awkward problems to the proposition that nuclear weapons have no use or must not have no use. But I think that even that time is kind of somewhat behind us, including the time of the Evans and Kamaguchi Commission. because the world hasn't stood still, and certainly since 2014 we are in a different era again, where the specter of great power conflict has very much returned to the center of international security concerns. Russia and China today make no qualms about the fact that they seek the conventional ability to dominate U.S. allies in their immediate neighborhood at will. And they've, over recent years, made steady progress in building the conventional forces to the point where that's no mere bluster anymore. But if their conventional superiority is regional, it is not global. Ultimately, Western security still depends on the ability of the U.S. and its allies to mobilize forces, bring them into the theater, and roll back any initial gains that adversaries may make to restore the security and freedom of allied territory. Both Russia and China need something to disrupt that mobilization, and this is where nuclear weapons come back into the picture. If you look at where Russia and China put their money these days in nuclear modernization, it's into nuclear capabilities for exactly this kind of limited use that might disrupt Western mobilization. In Russia's case, it's short-range Iskander ballistic missiles, for example, and a variety of modern naval weapons, nuclear depth charges, nuclear torpedoes, nuclear cruise missiles, that could be used against Western naval forces with limited civilian casualties and in a geographically constrained manner. Likewise, China has modernized its intercontinental forces, but priority in its nuclear modernization seems to lie on shorter range DF-21 and DF-26, which have no other use than to target U.S. bases in the Western, in forces in the Western Pacific. So far, we've not really found a way to answer to this new threat. It does risk us in leaving us in a situation where either Russia or China might cross the nuclear threshold in a great power conflict, and the U.S. today and its allies have little credible answers on what to do against the limited nuclear use that might come early in a conflict, that might just sink a ship or might just flatten some trees in Poland, but nonetheless creates the specter of one side having demonstrated that they are willing to cross the nuclear threshold and the other side just with a choice between accepting defeat or suicidal response. So the more that we have convinced ourselves and built an arsenal that is indeed unusable, the more, ironically, nuclear weapons have become more useful again for potential adversaries. I think this is starting to change. In the recent nuclear posture review, the Pentagon has now taken initial steps to recognize and address this problem. We've seen a commitment to the modernization of the tactical B-61 nuclear weapon and to the deployment of or development of sea-based lower-yield warheads as a means to start rebuilding those capabilities. In general, since 2014, NATO has rediscovered the old adage that if conventional defeat of the alliance is unacceptable, it does need credible options to use and react to the use of nuclear weapons, even if those are of the limited type that I've just described. And in this context, I think we shouldn't underestimate, for example, the importance that the alliance at the recent summit in Brussels has finally come together to call out Russia on its violation of the INF Treaty, which opens now the political space to begin discussions about possible adoptions to NATO's nuclear posture in response. So what does it all mean to Australia, this changing world? First, I think, insofar as we continue to rely for our security on the role of allied great powers in shaping global order, we need to recognize that ability of our allies to shape international order continues to rest to a large extent on their nuclear arsenals, just as it did in the 1950s at the beginning of the atomic age. We're not at the front lines of any of these confrontations, unlike U.S. allies in the Northern Hemisphere. But that doesn't mean that other countries won't or shouldn't have expectations that Australia also carries some of the political and strategic cost and burden of nuclear deterrence at the global level. Luckily, nobody has any use of Australia to contest nuclear weapons anymore, but I think we do have an important role to play, even in operational space, whether you think about the joint facilities or Australia's increasing importance as a rear area for U.S. operations in Asia. And I think Australia also, because of its long history of support for for an arms control and disarmament, has the credibility and the ability to shape the international debate, and what does it mean to be a responsible nuclear power? What are the real obstacles to nuclear disarmament, and how do we manage nuclear threats in the world as it is rather than that world that we'd like it to be? But if nuclear weapons are really not to be used, and they must not have any use for anybody, and at the moment that's simply not yet the case.